Blog Talk Radio.
Live to see it, friends. You're listening to The World Transformed 1.5 on Fast Forward Radio. I'm Phil Bauermaster, and I'm pleased to welcome you to this, the seventh installment of The World Transformed 1.5. This is our special series that bridges the gap between the original World Transformed, which aired in 2009, and The World Transformed 2, which is coming up a little bit later this year. Today, we're going to be talking about the make-it-yourself world. So let's get started. In his book, Hackers, published in 1984, Stephen Levy tells how a collection of unpaid and underpaid enthusiasts, many amateurs and hobbyists, ushered in a new technological and economic era, namely the era we live in now, the era of personal computers, the web, social media, and smartphones. How much of your life these days is spent using these technologies? It's a little dizzying to consider the impact that an outfit such as the Homebrew Computer Club, or earlier and even more implausible sounding, the Tech Model Railroad Club, could have on history. These guys truly changed the world. In Cory Doctorow's novel Makers, published in 2009, history repeats itself as a whole new paradigm for designing, producing, and distributing goods emerges from the efforts of a few dedicated 3D printer enthusiasts. Makers is in many ways a sequel to Hackers, even though the former is history and the latter is science fiction. The story of how we came to be on the verge of living in a make-it-yourself world follows precisely this trajectory. First came history, then came the science fiction story. And where we're living now, that's pretty much the science fiction story. But let's back up and look at the history. Over the past few weeks, I've been talking a lot about human history as a kind of grand, sweeping proposition. A sweeping historical perspective is important because we're witnessing in the world today the kinds of changes that once took centuries or millennia or even longer epochs. A couple of weeks ago, I mentioned three earlier singularities in human history, one of which was the development of agriculture, roughly 10,000 years ago. In his book, The Rational Optimist, Matt Ridley describes the emergence of trade as a major social force as being the fundamental driver of the move to agriculture. Along with agriculture, and occurring in very roughly the same time frame, both trade and the invention of written language are major disruptive changes in the history of humanity, and some might describe both of them as singularities in their own right. One of the major differences between how we live and how our hunter-gatherer ancestors lived is that very little of what we own or wear or use today is produced by ourselves or our immediate family or neighbors. For our remote ancestors, the opposite was the case. Almost everything they had came from their neighbors or families, or likely as not, from their own hands. Agriculture led to civilization, and trade led to globalization via the first truly global enterprises, the ancient empires. These shifts allowed humanity to develop far more specialized roles, enabling some individuals and groups to focus on performing certain tasks or producing certain goods. In his book, Ridley explains how specialization opened up tremendous new economic activity, resulting in an abundance of material wealth unlike anything the world had seen before. But in spite of this move towards specialization, much of humanity's day-to-day experience continued to mirror the experience of our pre-industrial ancestors. For people in the pre-industrial world, as in the pre-agricultural or pre-civilized world, most of life centered around the home. And most of the material goods they used or consumed continued to come from nearby, if not from their own homes. It was that next singularity, the Industrial Revolution, that truly accelerated specialization of labor and moved the focus of economic activity out of the home. Industrialization was also the accelerator of another closely related shift, which began with the move from nomadic to settled life, but really picked up speed with the move from pastoral or village life to city life. That shift is the increasing reliance on collective enterprises, the dominance of large institutions. Glenn Reynolds has written about the role that technology played in bringing about those changes. He writes, quote, "Big organizations doing big things. It's the story of the 19th and 20th centuries. In fact, it was so much the theme of those centuries that it's easy to forget what a departure this was from the rest of human history. But it was a huge departure, brought about by the confluence of some unusual technological and social developments. And it was a mixed bag. On the one hand, it made people in industrialized countries a lot richer. On the other hand, it created a lot of social strain, as traditional ways of living were disrupted by the new ways of doing business. Parents and children were separated. Husbands and wives were separated. Work became something separate from the rest of life, and itself became different. An old-style blacksmith made a plowshare or a sword from beginning to end. A worker in Adam Smith's needle factory or Henry Ford's automobile factory performed a single repetitive task with no real connection, emotional or intellectual, to the overall product." End quote. The assumption for the past 100 years or so has been that these trends would continue. Work would become more highly specialized, large institutions would grow even bigger and more powerful, and life would become even more alienated from the home. But then, something surprising happened. The Industrial Revolution was quickly followed by the Information Revolution and Moore's Law. Suddenly, instead of everything always getting bigger, some things were getting smaller. Suddenly, we had a situation where smaller things could be just as powerful as big things, if not more powerful. When the tiny microchip replaced the massive diesel engine as the driver of economic growth, vast organizational structures started to look, well, if not obsolete, maybe a little superfluous. Let me relate a story from my own past. Years ago, just when desktop publishing was becoming huge, I worked for a software company that sold a typographical and page layout system. One of our favorite marketing taglines was a quote variously attributed to Ben Franklin, William Randolph Hearst, and others, "The power of the press belongs to those who own one." Now, this quote has since taken on new meaning in the age of blogs. After 25 years or so, it's easy to forget that a small revolution in its own right occurred when, all of a sudden, virtually anyone, anywhere, could produce typeset copy. If you wanted to be a publisher, all you needed was a computer, a laser printer, and access to a photocopier. Publishing, or at least a good-sized piece of it, was deindustrialized. That is to say, the big industrial components that only a big company or government agency could afford to purchase, house, and operate, in this case, a linotype machine and an offset press, were made optional. Over the past two decades, deindustrialization has emerged in many other areas. The recording industry has been massively deindustrialized. The equipment for making a musical recording has been simplified, but that's nothing compared to the change in infrastructure used to distribute a recording. We no longer need factories to press vinyl records. At this point, even burning CDs is a quaint and clunky process. Does anybody even do it anymore? Earlier this week, Stephen and I hosted a panel discussion among the organizers of the Bill Conference. One of the sessions that took place at the conference had the wonderful title, "Make Your Own Damn TV Show." The first line of the conference guide description for that session reads, quote, "The tools of professional-level filmmaking and distribution are available to almost everyone with an internet connection and an entry-level camera," end quote. When you consider the massive infrastructure and large numbers of people that were required for film or television production even a couple of decades ago, this is really a remarkable statement, but it's absolutely true. Moreover, deindustrialization is not limited to publishing and other communications technology. As Stephen and I, mostly Stephen, have written about extensively over the past few years, the end of industrialization as we know it comes when individuals can produce their own goods, and possibly even the energy to produce those goods, on their own. The Industrial Revolution came about in the first place because bigger was better. A factory was far more efficient at producing widgets than a single skilled widget man. With fab technology, that will no longer necessarily be the case. The desktop fabricator, a grown-up version of the 3D printers we're seeing today, won't be specialized to produce one particular thing. It will produce tens of thousands of different objects, and it will be no more or less efficient to produce one or 1,000 units. Dr. Adrian Boyer has been instrumental in leading us towards this future. He is the founder of the RepRap project, aimed at producing an open source 3D printer capable of replicating itself. He lays out the rationale for the rep wrap as follows, quote, "These days, most people in the developed world run a professional quality printworks, photographic lab, and CD processing plant in their own house, all courtesy of their home PC. Why shouldn't they also run their own desktop factory capable of making many of the things they presently buy in shops, too? The possibilities are endless. Now people can make exactly what they want. If the design of an existing object does not suit their needs, they can easily redesign it on their PC and print that out, instead of making do with a mass-produced second-best design from the shops. They can also print out extra rep-wrap printers to give to their friends. Then those friends can make what they want, too." End quote. What Dr. Boyer is describing is a make-it-yourself world. For those who are so inclined, it will be a stay-at-home make-it-yourself world. We may be on the verge of recapturing some of the independence we had in the days before industrialization. But the changes are much bigger than that. A quote from The Guardian put it this way, "Rep-wrap has been called the invention that will bring down global capitalism, start a second industrial revolution, and save the environment." Well, we'll see about that. But even if personal fabrication delivers those kinds of spectacular results, I don't think we'll see the complete disappearance of industrial society. There will still be large corporations and government entities. Many of us will continue to live standardized lives with sharp distinctions between the home and the office, recreation and work, career and family, and so forth. But as these distinctions will be increasingly seen as optional, as is already the case for many who now work from home, their employers having partially deindustrialized the notion of workplace, human society will begin to evolve into something new. Yes, these new ways of organizing ourselves will have some things in common with our remote past that industrial society did not. Easing the distinction between workplace and home sounds nice. Easing the distinction between work and play sounds fantastic, but we aren't moving back to the hunter-gatherer days or to any model we can easily identify. The new make-it-yourself world will be as much a surprise to us or our descendants as industrial society was to the descendants of our agrarian ancestors. One thing is for sure, on the trajectory I mentioned earlier, we're definitely now living in a science fiction story. Please join us Monday evening as we dip into the archives once again, a show from 2008 featuring Stephen and myself and Michael Darling trying out new special features on Fast Forward Radio. You can listen and you can find out which of those stuck around, which only got aired that one time. On Wednesday, we got a big show. We're joined by our good friend, science fiction author Tobias Buckell. He'll be talking about his latest project, and I'm sure we'll also discuss the future of publishing. One week from tonight, I'll continue with part 8 of The World Transformed 1.5, and we'll talk a little bit more about this science fiction story that we're currently living in. Well, I hope you'll be able to join us for all of our upcoming programs. And until next time, live to see it. You're listening to The World Transformed 1.5. If you've joined us late, our program for today will repeat beginning right now. Live to see it, friends. You're listening to The World Transformed 1.5 on Fast Forward Radio. I'm Phil Bauermaster, and I'm pleased to welcome you to this, the seventh installment of The World Transformed 1.5. This is our special series that bridges the gap between the original World Transformed, which aired in 2009, and The World Transformed 2, which is coming up a little bit later this year. Today, we're going to be talking about the make-it-yourself world. So, let's get started. In his book Hackers, published in 1984, Stephen Levy tells how a collection of unpaid and underpaid enthusiasts, many amateurs and hobbyists, ushered in a new technological and economic era, namely the era we live in now, the era of personal computers, the web, social media, and smartphones. How much of your life these days is spent using these technologies? It's a little dizzying to consider the impact that an outfit such as the Homebrew Computer Club, or earlier and even more implausible sounding, the Tech Model Railroad Club, could have on history. These guys truly changed the world. In Cory Doctorow's novel Makers, published in 2009, history repeats itself as a whole new paradigm for designing, producing, and distributing goods emerges from the efforts of a few dedicated 3D printer enthusiasts. Makers is in many ways a sequel to Hackers, even though the former is history and the latter is science fiction. The story of how we came to be on the verge of living in a make-it-yourself world follows precisely this trajectory. First came history, then came the science fiction story. And where we're living now, that's pretty much the science fiction story. But let's back up and look at the history. Over the past few weeks, I've been talking a lot about human history as a kind of grand, sweeping proposition. A sweeping historical perspective is important because we're witnessing in the world today the kinds of changes that once took centuries or millennia or even longer epochs. A couple of weeks ago, I mentioned three earlier singularities in human history, one of which was the development of agriculture, roughly 10,000 years ago. In his book, The Rational Optimist, Matt Ridley describes the emergence of trade as a major social force as being the fundamental driver of the move to agriculture. Along with agriculture, and occurring in very roughly the same time frame, both trade and the invention of written language are major disruptive changes in the history of humanity, and some might describe both of them as singularities in their own right. One of the major differences between how we live and how our hunter-gatherer ancestors lived is that very little of what we own or wear or use today is produced by ourselves or our immediate family or neighbors. For our remote ancestors, the opposite was the case. Almost everything they had came from their neighbors or families, or likely as not, from their own hands. Agriculture led to civilization, and trade led to globalization via the first truly global enterprises, the ancient empires. These shifts allowed humanity to develop far more specialized roles, enabling some individuals and groups to focus on performing certain tasks or producing certain goods. In his book, Ridley explains how specialization opened up tremendous new economic activity, resulting in an abundance of material wealth unlike anything the world had seen before. But in spite of this move towards specialization, much of humanity's day-to-day experience continued to mirror the experience of our pre-industrial ancestors. For people in the pre-industrial world, as in the pre-agricultural or pre-civilized world, most of life centered around the home. And most of the material goods they used or consumed continued to come from nearby, if not from their own homes. It was that next singularity, the Industrial Revolution, that truly accelerated specialization of labor and moved the focus of economic activity out of the home. Industrialization was also the accelerator of another closely related shift, which began with the move from nomadic to settled life, but really picked up speed with the move from pastoral or village life to city life. That shift is the increasing reliance on collective enterprises, the dominance of large institutions. Glenn Reynolds has written about the role that technology played in bringing about those changes. He writes, quote, "Big organizations doing big things. It's the story of the 19th and 20th centuries. In fact, it was so much the theme of those centuries that it's easy to forget what a departure this was from the rest of human history. But it was a huge departure, brought about by the confluence of some unusual technological and social developments. And it was a mixed bag. On the one hand, it made people in industrialized countries a lot richer. On the other hand, it created a lot of social strain, as traditional ways of living were disrupted by the new ways of doing business. Parents and children were separated. Husbands and wives were separated. Work became something separate from the rest of life, and itself became different. An old-style blacksmith made a plowshare or a sword from beginning to end. A worker in Adam Smith's needle factory or Henry Ford's automobile factory performed a single repetitive task with no real connection, emotional or intellectual, to the overall product. End quote. The assumption for the past 100 years or so has been that these trends would continue. Work would become more highly specialized, large institutions would grow even bigger and more powerful, and life would become even more alienated from the home. But then, something surprising happened. The Industrial Revolution was quickly followed by the Information Revolution and Moore's Law. Suddenly, instead of everything always getting bigger, some things were getting smaller. Suddenly, we had a situation where smaller things could be just as powerful as big things, if not more powerful. When the tiny microchip replaced the massive diesel engine as the driver of economic growth, vast organizational structures started to look, well, if not obsolete, maybe a little superfluous. Let me relate a story from my own past. Years ago, just when desktop publishing was becoming huge, I worked for a software company that sold a typographical and page layout system. One of our favorite marketing taglines was a quote variously attributed to Ben Franklin, William Randolph Hearst, and others, "The power of the press belongs to those who own one." Now, this quote has since taken on new meaning in the age of blogs. After 25 years or so, it's easy to forget that a small revolution in its own right occurred when, all of a sudden, virtually anyone, anywhere, could produce typeset copy. If you wanted to be a publisher, all you needed was a computer, a laser printer, and access to a photocopier. Publishing, or at least a good-sized piece of it, was deindustrialized. That is to say, the big industrial components that only a big company or government agency could afford to purchase, house, and operate, in this case a linotype machine and an offset press, were made optional. Over the past two decades, deindustrialization has emerged in many other areas. The recording industry has been massively deindustrialized. The equipment for making a musical recording has been simplified, but that's nothing compared to the change in infrastructure used to distribute a recording. We no longer need factories to press vinyl records. At this point, even burning CDs is a quaint and clunky process. Does anybody even do it anymore? Earlier this week, Stephen and I hosted a panel discussion among the organizers of the Bill Conference. One of the sessions that took place at the conference had the wonderful title, "Make Your Own Damn TV Show." The first line of the conference guide description for that session reads, quote, "The tools of professional-level filmmaking and distribution are available to almost everyone with an internet connection and an entry-level camera," end quote. When you consider the massive infrastructure and large numbers of people that were required for film or television production even a couple of decades ago, this is really a remarkable statement, but it's absolutely true. Moreover, deindustrialization is not limited to publishing and other communications technology. As Stephen and I, mostly Stephen, have written about extensively over the past few years, the end of industrialization as we know it comes when individuals can produce their own goods, and possibly even the energy to produce those goods on their own. The Industrial Revolution came about in the first place because bigger was better. A factory was far more efficient at producing widgets than a single skilled widget man. With fab technology, that will no longer necessarily be the case. The desktop fabricator, a grown-up version of the 3D printers we're seeing today, won't be specialized to produce one particular thing. It will produce tens of thousands of different objects, and it will be no more or less efficient to produce one or 1,000 units. Dr. Adrian Boyer has been instrumental in leading us towards this future. He is the founder of the RepRap project, aimed at producing an open source 3D printer capable of replicating itself. He lays out the rationale for the RepRap as follows, quote, "These days, most people in the developed world run a professional quality print works, photographic lab, and CD processing plant in their own house, all courtesy of their home PC. Why shouldn't they also run their own desktop factory capable of making many of the things they presently buy in shops, too? The possibilities are endless. Now people can make exactly what they want. If the design of an existing object does not suit their needs, they can easily redesign it on their PC and print that out, instead of making do with a mass-produced second-best design from the shops. They can also print out extra RepRap printers to give to their friends. Then those friends can make what they want, too." End quote. What Dr. Boyer is describing is a make-it-yourself world. For those who are so inclined, it will be a stay-at-home, make-it-yourself world. We may be on the verge of recapturing some of the independence we had in the days before industrialization. But the changes are much bigger than that. A quote from The Guardian put it this way: RepRap has been called the invention that will bring down global capitalism, start a second industrial revolution, and save the environment. Well, we'll see about that. But even if personal fabrication delivers those kinds of spectacular results, I don't think we'll see the complete disappearance of industrial society. There will still be large corporations and government entities. Many of us will continue to live standardized lives with sharp distinctions between the home and the office, recreation and work, career and family, and so forth. But as these distinctions will be increasingly seen as optional, as is already the case for many who now work from home, their employers having partially deindustrialized the notion of workplace, human society will begin to evolve into something new. Yes, these new ways of organizing ourselves will have some things in common with our remote past that industrial society did not. Easing the distinction between workplace and home sounds nice. Easing the distinction between work and play sounds fantastic, but we aren't moving back to the hunter-gatherer days or to any model we can easily identify. The new make-it-yourself world will be as much a surprise to us or our descendants as industrial society was to the descendants of our agrarian ancestors. One thing is for sure. On the trajectory I mentioned earlier, we're definitely now living in a science fiction story. Please join us Monday evening as we dip into the archives once again. A show from 2008 featuring Stephen and myself and Michael Darling trying out new special features on Fast Forward Radio. You can listen and you can find out which of those stuck around, which only got aired that one time. On Wednesday, we got a big show. We're joined by our good friend, science fiction author Tobias Buckell. He'll be talking about his latest project, and I'm sure we'll also discuss the future of publishing. One week from tonight, I'll continue with part 8 of The World Transformed 1.5, and we'll talk a little bit more about this science fiction story that we're currently living in. Well, I hope you'll be able to join us for all of our upcoming programs. And until next time, live to see it.